Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, as listeners and members of the Coast family know, the kind of material we cover on this program, night after night, we plunge headfirst into UFOs, ghosts, the paranormal, conspiracies, things that go bump in the night. Every now and then, though, we run face first into a mystery that is new, or at least one that has a new twist. After we hear about it, we never quite look at the world in the same way. And tonight, we've got one of those kind of programs. This is Spooky Stuff. And I think those of you who are listening tonight are going to remember this interview for a long time. It'll pop back into your heads the next time you go camping, or if you take the family to a national park, or even if you go for a hike through the woods near your house. It's not only one mystery, it's hundreds of mysteries, because that's how many people have vanished, as if into thin air. The true number could be much higher. Probably no one knows what it is. We really don't know. That's the flip side of this coin. Another mystery, why the government agencies in charge of our national parks and forests have kept a lid on this. They not only haven't told us, but have gone to great lengths to not even keep tabs on this confidentially, as if they don't want to know themselves. And they sure as hell don't want us to know either. Where have we heard that before? My guest is David Politis, a longtime lawman turned business executive turned Bigfoot hunter and author. David is one of my favorite guests. I've interviewed him on Coast a couple of times about his remarkably well-documented books about Sasquatch encounters among Native Americans. That work sort of led him to the subject at hand. He started looking into disappearances in wilderness areas, national parks and forests, and ran into a stone wall. But he's compiled this gigantic collection of missing person files, so many that he couldn't fit them all into one book, so he's written two. The title of both is Missing 411, but he has subtitles. One of the books focuses on the western U.S. and Canada, the other on the eastern part of our country. No matter where you live and where you're listening to this program from, there's a case, maybe several cases, not that far from your home. And the millions of people who visit national parks every year need to know about this, need to be aware so they can pay attention, take precautions. But the government sure as hell isn't going to tell you about it. Dave Politis is. And yes, when I first heard the premise, I thought, well, there could be all sorts of reasons why people vanish out in the woods. I mean, it's easy to get lost out there. That's wilderness. People can get hurt. They get attacked by animals. Sometimes they could be kidnapped by criminals operating out there or crazy people. But as you will hear, the weird circumstances that pop up in these case files over and over make it clear that something else is afoot here. People are being snatched, taken, lured, some of them almost entranced. We'll approach the topic in sort of the same way that Dave lays out his books, case by case, because I think that's the best way to point out that explaining all of this is not going to be easy. There's no one-sentence explanation that'll make them all go away. It's just weird. And some of these tales will chill you right down to the marrow of your bones. We'll need more than the usual time to cover all this ground, so Dave will be joining me in just a few minutes from now. A couple of quick news notes, though. A monster earthquake in the ocean off the coast of central Chile today, 7.2 on the Richter scale. The government there ordered the evacuation of some coastal areas, fearing a tsunami. No word yet on deaths or injuries. In San Francisco, police have arrested a man in connection with the gruesome murders of five people. The bodies of three women and two men were found in a home on Friday. Officers today arrested a 35-year-old man who apparently knew the victims. He's been booked on five counts of murder. Former Vice President Dick Cheney recovering in Virginia after undergoing a heart transplant a couple of days ago. His doctors today defended the operation, said Cheney did not get any special treatment in obtaining his donor heart. Cheney suffered five heart attacks over the past few years, so he certainly needed a new ticker. Heck of an interesting story unfolding out in the Pacific Ocean. Filmmaker James Cameron is waiting to take a little dive to the bottom, way down to the bottom, the bottom of the Mariani Trench, the deepest point on Earth. 7 miles down, they figure they'll dive, which would be the deepest anyone has ever gone. Bad weather postponed the dive, according to the AP. We have a story about it on the Coast website. Also there, a new edition of Naps News, compiled by webmaster Tim Binal and me. One story on our list about President Obama's visit to Roswell a couple of days ago. While he's there, of course, he made some wisecracks about he still wants to keep all the secrets, an offhand reference, of course, to the Roswell incident. Yuckity yuck yuck. Real funny stuff. I'd say it's even less funny when you look at the record of the Obama administration on issues of openness in government. Despite all the promises that he made as a candidate, by some standard, he's even less open, has thrown up more roadblocks to freedom of information than his predecessor, who was pretty bad about secrecy in government. Also, there is a link to the National Security Archives. If you want to know how our government keeps tabs on what everyone else has underground, facilities-wise, base-wise, there's a pretty cool report on this link here. And if you follow national security and secrecy issues, that website is one great resource. If you think UFO sightings started with Kenneth Arnold in 1947, check another link we have in Naps News. It's about early American UFO sightings as far back as 1639. A couple of other newsworthy bits and pieces there, including sightings of a dog-headed pig monster in Africa. Take a look at all that when you get some time. Time now to jump feet first into the deep end of the pool. What has happened to hundreds of people who vanished into thin air? We'll hear the story from David Politis right after this on Coast to Coast AM. As I mentioned, Dave Politis has been my guest a couple of times on this program, and I find him to be one of the very most credible, most knowledgeable interviewees when the subject comes to Bigfoot, Sasquatch. He holds 2 degrees from the University of San Francisco, spent 20 years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector, had a boyhood camping experience with his father in the late 60s that got him hooked on the subject of Bigfoot, and then a couple of years ago, he was one of the founders of the North America Bigfoot Search, written a couple of really excellent books on it. And I suspect that it was his interest in that topic that got him started on this one. But the new book is, as I mentioned, Missing 411, 2 volumes. Dave, great to have you back on the program.
Hey, George, thanks for having me.
Spooky stuff. Spooky.
It's very, very strange.
Let's start this way. You started asking questions at the at national parks, asking questions. I can guess what they were about. And you sort of caused a little hubbub within the National Park Service. They're not being very cooperative, but one night you get a knock on the door. You don't want to say where because you don't want to give the source away, but tell me that story and how you started down this path.
So I was in the park and just asking some questions, talking to people. I usually don't go to the Park Service themselves because they're pretty closed-mouthed about things, but some of the employees on the periphery that are employed by the concessionaires and things, they talk. And it got around that I was there, and there aren't many places to stay in the location I was at. And in the middle of, just before we went to bed, there was a knock at the door, and the guy says, Dave, you probably don't know me, but I heard you were in the park. I know of your work. I know of your background. And I think there's a story here that you would be apt to investigate, and I think there's something there. And he came in, and we ended up talking for quite a while. And he had worked at a couple of different parks, and he had experienced the same phenomena at each park, and that is that there were disappearances in the park that didn't make a lot of sense on the front, and there wasn't much investigation going on the back end after the people disappeared, and there was even fewer press releases and press follow-up and media coverage about the issues. And he said that he thought that it was unusual and it wasn't normal, and if it had happened in a city or in a county where there was sheriff's officer PD jurisdiction, that it would be getting far more press and far more follow-up, and he just thought it was very odd that this kept recurring where he was at. And he says, you know, I don't want to raise a red flag, but I know you do thorough investigations, and, you know, maybe you'd look into this. I said, oh, it sounds interesting, and for sure. And he left. I only had one conversation with this person, never had another conversation with him again, didn't do any follow-up with him. And on the way home, I had a few conversations with some people that I work with, and I threw the idea by him. I said, get on the computer, see what you can find. And right away, they did some archive search, and they said, you know, there's something here. And that started a 3-plus-year, 7,000-hour investigation that ended up covering North America, U.S. and Canada. And we ended up phenomenally, finding 28 clusters of missing people in rural areas of North America. And that includes not only national parks, national forests. This could be just open space of the Department of the Interior. And even one of our clusters is the entire state of Pennsylvania. And I know that may not make sense when I'm saying it right now, but it, in a speck of time in the late 40s and 50s, there were so many missing kids in that state that disappeared under phenomenally similar circumstances that I know that nobody would have been able to put it together unless you sat down and did something stupid like we did and just gnawed away at the data. And the way they disappeared, the times they disappeared, the locations, it just all falls in a very strange phenomena.
You know, when you were first telling me what you were working on some time ago, I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, but it would take a lot of convincing because, of course, it is wilderness. It's wild. It's the woods. People get lost in the woods. People get lost out in the middle of nowhere. They fall down. They hurt themselves. They get disoriented. Bad weather, animal attacks, whatever. Just seemed to me like, you know, I could think of a lot of reasons why people would disappear out there. But you're talking about something at a whole different level. Why don't we approach that in a general, talk about the general premise, and then we'll get into some specifics.
So let's separate disappearances between voluntary and involuntary. A lot of people want to disappear. They may be suicidal. They just want to fall out of the world. They want to take off. There's no crime in that. They can do it. And let's say that's adults. But when you talk about kids, and I say kids, say anything under than 10, 11, 12, I have two. I can't see my kids wanting to even step more than 100 feet away from our campsite, especially when it's starting to get dark, because there's always this stigma about darkness and forest. And so those are involuntary disappearances. And when you look at those and you start to look at hundreds of cases, you start to see similarities that start staring at you. And your initial assessment that, yeah, people disappear in the woods, yeah, it's a natural phenomena. It happens. Exactly, it does happen. But if there's an animal attack, let's say a bear attack or a mountain lion attack, there's going to be fallout from that that searchers and law enforcement personnel are going to find. They're going to find a lot of tracks. There's going to be a
blood.
Lot of blood.
Yeah.
There might be a lot of clothing. But in these disappearances, you're not finding that. And when they bring tracking dogs in, canines, bloodhounds, they do strange things. And a lot of times, they can't even find a scent. But at other times, when you read the search and rescue logs or you read the articles in the papers from years and years ago, every once in a while, there's something very critical in there that a lot of writers and a lot of search and rescue people won't put in, but that is, the dog sits down and won't search. It'll walk up to a fork in a trail, and it'll just stop. And the handler will put a note in there, unusual, dog won't move, or dog doesn't feel like searching, or whatever it might be. The other part that's unusually strange, and search and rescue people have faced this hundreds of times, and that is that the canine or the bloodhound will track to a river. And we're talking a big river. A tough one for you and I to cross, but any kid under 10 would never cross it. And they track it to a river. Well, assessment is the kid went in the river, kid drowned. And that's essentially the end of the search. If they're really thorough, and this has happened a couple times, they'll dam the river, get permission from Fish and Game, shut it down, and search. And every one of the times they've done that, they never find the missing child. Now, a few of the times, under very unusual circumstances, search and rescue professional says, we'll search the other side just for the heck of it. And son of a gun, if not on the other side, miles away, they find the kid. Now, how did the kid cross the river? Now, search and rescue people won't answer it, and it's left in the dark, and it's never answered in a report. But the question is, how did the kid get across?
It's not only rivers. I should say I think that was the eeriest part of the book, is reading about the distance that some of these kids travel, dead of winter, no shoes on. They are found, and they're going counterintuitively up mountains. Talk about that in generalities, and then we'll get into it in specifics.
So in the search and rescue world, there's parameters that are set down based on topography, whether it's hilly ground, flat ground, river, water, cold, wet, dry, hot. And they base it on the age, the health, and on these topographical conditions about how far to set out the grid pattern. And many, and we'll talk about kids here, many of these times in these cases, these kids are found way outside the parameters. And I'm not talking 25% outside. I'm talking several hundred percent outside. And just like you said, one of the common themes that you'll read about in these stories is that the kids are found without shoes. Now, what I keep looking to find in the reports is when the child's found, I want to know what the condition of their feet are. But it's never mentioned. Because my question is that if their feet walked 14 miles over three mountain ranges in 14 hours at the age of 8 years old, well, those feet must be destroyed. But they never mention it. And if you read the guidelines on the search and rescue versus what's found here, they make completely no sense. And I think a lot of times the search and rescue people are perplexed, but they do an extremely competent job with the parameters that they have. And when they reach these cases that are completely outside the norm, I think many times the kids may never be found because there's no rational reason to search out that far.
One of the other things, I we'll talk about this generally too and then get specifics as we go along, is the clothing. You mentioned about having kids having no shoes on, that you would find pieces of clothing here or there, but there's some really weird stuff goes on with clothing that further perplexes the whole thing, in that, you know, a bear attacks somebody and eats them, there are going to be bits and pieces of clothing show up in the scat. It doesn't happen in these cases. In fact, some of the clothes look like they're taken off and just folded there, kind of thing.
Yeah, there's several cases where people are eaten up, and there's just bits and pieces of them. And they find a pair of pants nearby where one of the pant legs or both pant legs are turned inside out, as though something has taken the pants off of the people before they ate them. And then scat nearby of a bear is analyzed, and there's no human remains in the scat, and there's no clothing remains. And later we can talk about a case out of the Yukon Territory with a really famous guy named Bart Schleyer, exactly what happened. Another case out of northern Canada with a young girl, same thing happened. Now, if I talked about this by itself, say Schleyer's case or the girl in northern Canada, no one would think much about it, and it was an anomaly. But I know that nobody has ever put multiple cases together like this and said, wow, what's happening? This can't be coincidence. There's got to be a reason. Somebody wrote to me a while ago, and they said, Dave, we just read your book, and oh my God, this applies. And it's a theme out of James Bond. And he said, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three time is enemy action. And that's kind of what I think sometimes with this, because it happens too many times to be coincidence.
Well, as I said, we're going to get into specifics. I intentionally want to focus after this break. I want to focus on the National Park Service, federal agencies, I guess, including the FBI, because am I correct in putting it this way, that you ran into a stone wall right from the get-go?
That'd be a fair assessment.
And so were you able to, I can't tell if you were able to, I know a lot of these files, you rely on media reports, so you know that these incidents happened, but did you ultimately fail in getting all the information that you wanted to get using Freedom of Information?
So one thing I say in the book is that the people that work in the park that you and I see when we drive in, those people are phenomenal. They service us. They work for the good of the Park Service. They know nothing about what we're talking about. I'm talking about probably the top 15 people in the Park Service know what we're talking about right now and know what they're doing, and they're doing it methodically and logically. And that is that they, when we first started off, we knew that the Park Service had one of the largest federal contingent law enforcement groups of any that patrol open spaces. With a law enforcement group that size, and the number of, there's over 350 different monuments, parks, et cetera, that they patrol, they've got to have a pretty good database of knowledge. And we have the Freedom of Information Act that's given to us by the government, where we can retrieve information and data from our federal agencies.
Dave, I'm going to ask you to stop right there, because I want to pick that story up when we come back, just how much difficulty you ran into right off the bat in dealing with the National Park Service in particular. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with David Politis about his new two-volume book, Missing 411. When we come back, we resume the conversation about the stone wall he ran into. And it's not just a refusal to give information. It's a real haughty attitude on the part of the National Park Service. That and more coming up on Coast to Coast AM. All right, David, you were saying before we took the break that the National Park Service has this gigantic law enforcement apparatus. And one would think if there are hundreds of people disappearing for whatever reason within the national parks, that they would keep some kind of a list and would want the public to know about it. What did you find?
Well, let's back up for a second. Let's just talk about a municipal law enforcement agency or a sheriff's department in the U.S. of moderate size. Almost all of them have a website, and almost all of them have a missing person aspect to that site, meaning that they list the people missing in that jurisdiction, date, time, location, etc. And it allows the public to keep an eye out for these people, let you know what's going on in the community, etc. Well, the National Park Service has a big website, and it has a lot of things on it. There's no missing person website. Portion to that website. There's no links. There's no mention of it anywhere. But, you know, with the knowledge that if I was running a national park and I had limited resources, I'd buy a clipboard with some graph paper, and every time somebody disappeared, I'd write their name down, the location they disappeared, age, etc. And that, if that would be the inexpensive way to keep a ledger of who was missing. If I could afford a laptop, I could keep 5,000 locations of people missing, and every month when the monthly reports roll in from the National Park Service's other locations to headquarters, I could easily keep track of that on a laptop. Well, through FOIA, we've filed a request to have a list of missing people inside their system. And this went through the Western Regional Office out of Denver, and a woman named Charis, C-H-A-R-I-S Wilson. She is a phenomenal person. She's done us a lot of, she does everything she can to help us, and she's running into a bureaucratic headstorm. And she sends me back a message after we make the request, and she says, Dave, headquarters says they don't have any lists. Well, All of us in law enforcement think, wait, it must be semantics. It can't be true. So I filed it a second time, rewording it. She comes back again, and she says, Dave, I'm really sorry. They say they don't have any list of any missing people. And I says, okay, how about individual parks? And she says, headquarters says, as far as they know, no parks keep lists of missing people. And I says, okay, Yosemite's pretty close to my house. That's a pretty big national park. They should have sufficient resources to do this. FOIA Yosemite and ask them. They come back and said, nope, Yosemite has no list of missing people. So in FOIA, there's an exemption to get data if you're a published author. So I'm not a world-famous author. I'm just your measly little author of two books. I asked for an author's exemption, and I asked for the data from Yosemite on missing people and to give me that data. They come back, and an attorney through FOIA for the Park Service says that my books aren't in enough libraries to get the publishers and authors exemption from paying the price. And if I wanted a list of missing people from Yosemite, it would cost me $34,000.
Jeez. That's just ridiculous. That's just ridiculous.
Well, I says, well, let's take it to the extreme. Let's really run with this. I FOIA'd headquarters. I says, okay, I want a list from the whole system. They come back and they say $1.4 million.
Obviously, they don't want you to have this list. They don't want to put it together. Let me ask the question this way. This is something they should have. It's not just an oversight that they don't have it. I mean, somebody had to make a conscious decision. We're not going to keep a list of this for whatever reason. Or would you agree with that?
So one of the guys we work with, he was the head of a state's law enforcement branch. He's a really, really smart guy. And we sat down and we talked about this, and he said, Dave, these people are not stupid. They obviously don't want the public to know, and they obviously don't want you to have it. And that's probably the best way it could be put.
So how did you get all the files then?
Well, that's a monumental piece of work right there. So every community just outside of a national park or a national monument keeps pretty good tabs on what happens. And the choice is you either go there and you sit in a library and you work it out and you get in tight with the librarian and you say, hey, do you have a lot of these libraries have files specifically for certain things. And some of these libraries had those files on missing people. And there's certain archive sites on the web that you can subscribe to. And if you're patient enough, and if you have the time, and you know how to query, you can get certain data out of there that's available. And through all of the above, in 3+ years worth of work, eventually this started to roll in.
So, for example, once you get a name of a missing person, say from a newspaper article, are you able to use that name and then force the file out of the Park Service or some other agency?
Sometimes, yes. It usually works the other way. You query, say, missing Glacier National Park. And sometimes it'll go back 30, 40, 50 years on some of the archived locations. Other times, not. And then you get the name and you FOIA the National Park for the file. Now, the interesting thing about that is one of the clusters of disappearances is Crater Lake. So we FOIA'd Crater Lake on a series of disappearances there. And again, Cheris from Denver comes back and says, Dave, I'm embarrassed to tell you, we lost all the files in 12 years at that park.
Huh. Oops.
I said, come on. And she goes, no, we really don't have them. I mean, I believe her because I believe what she's saying is the truth. But where are they?
Now that they know that they should have one of these, and they know you're going to stir up a lot of trouble over the fact that they don't have one, any response from them indicating they're putting one together or any indication that they're budging from this, this horrendous position?
So starting 3.5, approaching 4 years ago when this all started, they told me back then that they were obtaining a grant to start an intensive computer network amongst all of their parks, and this was something that they were going to implement. But like I told you at the beginning, this isn't rocket science, George. I mean, honest to God, with a clipboard and a piece of graph paper, you could start tracking this today.
Hmm.
And then every month, each park or each monument sends in a report to National Park Headquarters. Well, somebody's reading these. Somebody's taking notes and deriving statistical data. And knowing that missing people is a hot topic, that you would think that those statistics would be very important.
One other question on this. You got a call from some agent for the Park Service who went beyond just saying no to you. I mean, he really gave you some attitude, and you detail that in the book. Tell me about that.
So Yosemite is one of the biggest clusters of missing people anywhere. And if anyone's been to Yosemite, yeah, there's a lot of rock walls, there's a lot of canyons and things. But again, these disappearances don't fall into the realm of normality in any shape, way, or form. And I live in a suburb of San Jose, right near a city called Saratoga. And it just so happens a 15-year-old girl from Saratoga went missing in the early 1980s on a trip with her dad. And she was on horseback, and her dad were with 7 other people, and they rode into a remote area called Sunrise Camps, just outside of Tenaya Lake. And they were about 8,000, 9,000 feet up, and they rode into an area where there are remote cabins that you can stay at. Her name's Stacy, gets off her horse, her dad gets off her horse, she goes in the cabin, she changes. And there's a 71-year-old man that went along with the group, and she tells her dad, hey, I'm going to go with Mr. So-and-so, and we're going to walk out here to this point 100 feet away that everybody could see, and she brought her camera, and she's going to take some pictures. And the man walks out, and it's high elevation, and he tells Stacy, hey, I'm tired. I'm just going to sit down right here. Everybody sees the man sit down. Stacy tells the man, hey, I'm going to walk down this trail, and it's a very easy trail. It's almost all granite outcropping, very few trees, and I'm going to this lake that almost everybody can see, and she has to walk through a few trees to get to the lake. The man says he sees her walk through the trees, and she doesn't come back. And a large search ensues, and in years and years, they never find anything of Stacy. The only thing they found of hers was right inside that tree line. They found the cap to her camera, her lens cap. And that story intrigued me for several reasons. First of all, it's in an area of Yosemite that doesn't have a lot of trees. There's not a lot of places to hide. The elevation's high. There's a lot of lakes in that area. But it's an unusual case. A 15-year-old girl just vanishes. And to not find a body, not find clothing, not find shoes, something about her is really an unusual event. So I filed a FOIA against the Park Service. And this is probably the 25th or 28th time we filed one on an open missing persons case, meaning the person wasn't found. And just so the audience understands, a missing persons case in law enforcement is not considered a criminal event. It's one of those strange things that the police departments and sheriffs and law enforcement in general investigate, even though it's not a crime for a person to go missing. So it's not a crime. And we get almost 99.9% of all the FOIAs we ask for when the person is still missing. And the only one we've never gotten back is Stacy. And we got a refusal. And so I went back to Charis in Denver. I said, Charis, what's going on? She goes, Dave, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. Yosemite's being strange about this. So it gets back to the special agent, and that's the detective for the Park Service that does follow-up. And at about this time, there's a book written about life and death in Yosemite by a retired ranger named Butch Farabee. And Butch spent 30 years at various national parks. And there's so much death and strange events going on in Yosemite. He wrote a masterful book about it. And it wasn't just about deaths. It was about disappearances and things. And Butch wrote about Stacy. So I called him. I said, Butch, this is what I'm doing. It's a little different than yours. My scope's a little wider, but you did a great job on your book, and I want to know what happened with Stacy. He says, Dave, I saw the file. There shouldn't be any reason you don't have it. They looked at a lot of people at the time. There's no suspects. There's no nothing, Dave. I don't think they have anything on this, and I doubt if anybody's looked at it in 25 or 30 years. Well, out of the blue, I get this call from a special agent in Yosemite, and he says, right off the bat, says, what do you want this file for? Well, if you know, when you go asking for something, you know the law behind it before you start looking. And we know the law. And one of the criteria is, in FOIA, the rationale on why you want something from the government can't be a reason why they ask or why they grant or why they deny, and they can't even ask. This guy asks. I said, well, why are you asking me that? He says, hey, I know who you are, and I know your background, and I want to know why you want it. Says, well, I want it because I'm looking at missing people. I'm writing a book about missing people. Her case is highly unusual, and it's in my backyard. And he says, well, you're not going to get it. I said, what do you mean I'm not going to get it? It's an open missing persons case. And I said, is there any criminal element to that? Nope. I said, are there any suspects? Nope. And I said, well, why wouldn't you give it to me then? And he says, well, because we never give away these cases. I says, wait a minute. I have dozens and dozens of these cases from your agency all over the U.S. He goes, no, you don't. I go, yes, I do. And we get into this talk, and he challenges me. He's rude. He says right from the get-go, I'm never going to get this. And so far, he's right. I've appealed this to the National Park Service. I've gone to a congressman. They cannot get that file. Today, out of the blue, I get a call from the cousin of George Aris, who since is deceased, who actually went to the scene when Stacy disappeared and helped with the search efforts. And I explained to him what's going on. And he says he's going to try to intervene on behalf of the family to find out why this case isn't getting opened and released. And he's upset about it. So the point being is that, I mean, if you have nothing to conceal, why not show it? The agent said, well, if I give you the case, that'll compromise any future prosecution. Is it prosecution for what? Most of the people involved in this are dead. The 71-year-old man is long gone. Her dad's long gone. Half the people involved that were on that trip are deceased. Do you have a suspect? No. Are you investigating a crime? No. It's baffling.
Tell me this. Within your research, were you able to develop relationships with NPS staff members, former, maybe retired folks who would talk to you off the record about this? And if so, were you able to get any idea why they would cover this up? I mean, they must have some kind of idea what's going on, but either that or they just don't want to alarm the public so people don't would stop going to national parks.
So the perspective is that the average National Park Service employee is having a difficult life enough just doing their job day in and day out, and their vision of things is probably from 1,000 feet. You and I right now are rolling at 50,000 feet and looking at 350-plus different locations and seeing things from an entirely different perspective. The people, I would say, like I said, 99.5% of the Park Service doesn't have any fathom of a thought what you and I are discussing right now. And I don't blame them in the least for what's happening. It's that top realm in the Park Service that knows. One of the conversations I had was with the head of the Law Enforcement Bureau for the National Park Service. He kind of laughed and joked when I started to talk about the same things you and I are talking about here. Same thing. Well, Dave, people disappear. You know, it's not unusual. We deal with hundreds and hundreds of these events. And then they throw out this thing that you're going to hear many times, and I'm sure we're all going to hear it in the next few weeks. Do you know how many millions of people visit our park and have a safe trip? And I told them, I said, you know what? I know that is true, but the reality is that the Harris family had their life ruined. The Dennis Martin family in the Great Smoky Mountains had their life ruined. The Trini Gibson family in the Great Smoky Mountains had their life ruined. The Dennis Johnson family in Yellowstone National Park had their life ruined. And you know what? I don't care if you had 20 million people there. Something happened to those kids, and they were never found inside your system. So to throw around big numbers like that you have so many millions of visitors, it only takes one to ruin your whole life, and that ruined these people's lives. And they have no advocates, and they're not on any database. Why?
It would be like the FAA saying, yeah, I know, we had this terrible air disaster, and a plane crashed and killed 200 people, but most planes don't crash. They land safely, you know?
Same analogy. Exactly.
The other part of that question was whether you were able to develop any confidential sources within NPS or former folks who worked for them.
So in Crater Lake, there's a cluster of young men and boys that have disappeared. And these disappearances go back nearly 100 years to an individual named B.B. Bukowski, who back when the park was just very, very young, he pulled a sled in the middle of winter and was going to, he's a landscape photographer, and he was taking photos of the lake, the first time anyone had ever done it during the winter. And Bukowski was a pretty strong guy. He built a snow cave. He had all of his equipment there. Inexplicably, he disappeared. And that kind of started the whole thing in Crater Lake. Well, when I was there and when I tried to get the Park Service to release documents and they ended up losing these years and years of docs, I found a note in a file in Medford in a newspaper about a ranger that worked there and was involved in the recovery of a body of one of these young men. And what it was an individual that was 19 years old visiting the lake also during the winter, also a photographer.
David, I'm going to have to stop you there. I'm sorry. I didn't give you time enough to answer that. I apologize, but we'll pick up the story on the other side, and then we're going to get into specific cases and go down and cover as many of them as we can. Talking with David Politis, author of the new book, Missing 411. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.